This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Christopher Benfey, also known as Chris, about a book that he's written called Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay. It's a terrific book. And it has a subtitle, I should say, Reflections on Art, Family, and Survival. How are you, Chris?
Great. Nice to be here.
Well, this was an amazing find for me. I was driving through North Carolina, happened to stop off to visit old friends in Durham, and went to the Regulator Bookshop, and they had a little couple of shelves of North Carolina-related books, and there was this fantastic cover. And it just called out to me. I read it with, kind of immediate attraction. And so it's a pretty interesting structure for a book. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, the connective is North Carolina, at least it seems so to me, but it works through your family relationships. And the theme of, I would say, of clay, of the earth, is really throughout. I'm really curious what got you to start writing this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. The book was really a long time in coming, and I appreciate that generous prologue. I had the instinct that I wanted to write something memoir-ish, and I had a gut sense that that because my father's side of the family and my mother's side of the family kind of intersected in North Carolina in peculiar ways, I had some confidence that the book would have at least some major North Carolina crossings. But as I wrote parts of it, the book was just all over the place. And I finally started writing another book about Emily Dickinson and hummingbirds, mainly just to get some relief from the sprawling memoir. And I wrote this little book called A Summer of Hummingbirds while I kept kind of stowing away the materials for the memoir. And then something lucky happened. Books need luck. They need hard work, but they also need serendipity. I was invited to give a talk at Harvard for a symposium on Japanese pottery and the United States. And it was a topic that meant a lot to me. I had written an earlier book called The Great Wave about the Gilded Age American love affair with Japan and Japanese things. And I also knew that I wanted to say something about North Carolina pottery in relation to Japan. And somewhere in there, when I was writing that talk for this 2004 symposium at Harvard, I had the idea for this three-part talk. And I knew that I wanted to say something about the red brick world that my mother grew up in. Her father was a bricklayer, a brick mason, a mason in both senses of the word. I knew that I wanted to say something about the Black Mountain College world that my great uncle, the painter Joseph Albers, and his wife Annie Albers, the great weaver, had joined in 1933. And I had also begun getting inklings of this weird search for porcelain clay, for a perfect white clay, as white as snow, in the western part of the state. So I had this, it was really just a kind of an awakening moment for me when I thought, yeah, red brick, Black Mountain, white clay. It had a sort of Japanese sound to it. And I wrote the lecture, and I was lucky in the audience. Edmund Duval was there, who later, of course, achieved worldwide fame with his amazing book, The Hair with Amber Eyes. Edmund loved my talk, and we spent a lot of time together, and he told me the whole story that later became his international bestseller. And he really encouraged me with the book I was writing, and I strongly encouraged him. And we did a tour of Harvard looking at the brickwork in different buildings. That was we bonded over brick. And Edmund then blurred my book in a really generous way and helped sort of get it on its way. So once I had that three-part notion, the rest of the book sort of grew, crystallized around that three-part structure, and the earlier mess of the book sort of fell away, and I had the dun dun dun. You know, I had a sort of arpeggio that I could that I could build the book around.
Well, it's a very interesting. I noticed some of the people who blurbed the book kind of alluded to the way that the book doesn't really fit any categories. And I think that that's true, you know, that it is a memoir because it's about your family, but it's very different in that, you know, even though some of it is about you and your growing up, it's really more meditative and intellectual exploration than what maybe the parts of memoir that some people like a lot and other people don't, which is the exploration of self.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to flush the personal out of it as much as I could. I really want it to be a different kind of memoir. I wanted it to be an object-based memoir. There's a phrase that T.S. Eliot uses. He's talking about Hamlet and why Hamlet is a failure in his view. I mean, that's how you really get attention. You say, you know, Shakespeare wrote pretty well, but this Hamlet play, you know, there's some problems with it. And Eliot, I don't know, he was in his early 20s at the time. He said what Hamlet can't discover is an objective correlative for his feelings, which of course is an absolutely brilliant thing to say about the play, and it's not a weakness of the play. It's kind of what the play is about, you know, finding that objective correlative. I wanted my memoir to have that objective correlative. I wanted the feelings and the personal stuff in my own life to come through objects. And the main object, as you mentioned earlier, was this world of clay. There was a very early point in writing the book when I was going to call it something like Digging for China in Carolina. You know, there were enough Asian themes that I had that idea of sort of going through the layers of the earth until you end up with China on the other side, but also the idea of China clay, which was this beautiful white clay. Anyway, I ditched, so to speak, that title. But the idea of letting objects, pots, pitchers, vases, broken shards, mounds, mound building, to have the emotional narrative carried by a lot of objects with deep meanings, that really worked for me. And I remember when I was staring at this snuff box on my father's desk and realized that this little polyp motif on the snuff box had something to do with our own family on my father's side, German Jewish family, and a certain fantasy about sort of Greek, classical Greek themes in this upper class German Jewish family. And the snuff box took on for me some of the same sort of objective emotional quality as all of the North Carolina clay. So I should make clear, all marriages are mixed, and my parents came from these really different worlds. My mother came from the dirt poor, red clay area of central eastern North Carolina, the area known sort of wishfully as the Piedmont. And her father laid bricks and her grandfather laid bricks, and they all grew broadleaf tobacco for part of the year. And they all had livestock, and they were all poor, and they were all Methodists. And on my father's side, my father came from a really wealthy German Jewish family. They were converted Jews. All of these wealthy Jews converted around the turn of the century in Germany so that they could advance in their careers. My grandfather was a Supreme Court judge. My great-grandmother came from the Ullstein family, the wealthiest publishers in all of Europe between the wars. They made one of their many fortunes publishing All Quiet on the Western Front as a paperback by that German Jew Kramer, who reversed the letters to get the name Remark, Eric Maria Remark, Kramer. My father's family all turned into scum in 1933 when Hitler announced that Jews were not welcome in Germany. And my father spent the war years in England with a foster family, came to the United States, met my mother. And so out of that strange crossing, my childhood world came into being, and a lot of the book is just trying to sort out the two wildly different strands of this family of mine. My father's aunt and uncle, as I mentioned, ended up at Black Mountain College briefly. Joseph Albers was the chancellor of the school. He ran the arts program from 1933 to 1950, and Joseph Albers's imprint was really all over this legendary, incredible experiment in, I'm tempted to say an American education, but it's sort of more like international education, since Black Mountain was another strange marriage, like the marriage I was born into. Black Mountain College was a marriage of American mavericks like Buckminster Fuller, the incredible designer of everything, including the geodesic dome. I talk about in the book how he constructed his first successful geodesic dome, Black Mountain. John Cage was at Black Mountain College. Merce Cunningham, the great dancer. So there were all these maverick Americans, and then there were all of these refugees from fascist and Nazi Europe, including my great aunt and uncle, the Alberses.
Yeah, well, I think Black Mountain actually stands out because it did attract so many really interesting people. And, it just happens that just before finding your book, I was in Asheville, went to the Black Mountain Museum, which now exists there, and they happen to have a wonderful show of photography from Black Mountain, which included photographs of some of the people that you talk about and some that you just mentioned. Some great pictures of, Merce Cunningham dancing as a young person, Ruth Ozawa, and I think Karen Carnes was in that show as well.
Yeah, absolutely. She's sitting there with her husband at that time in the pottery shack. Great photographs of Robert Rauschenberg as a young student. Rauschenberg just had an appetite for absolutely everything. He took up weaving with Ani Albers. He took up dance with Merce Cunningham. There are great pictures of Rauschenberg dancing. He got his friend Cy Twombly to come and study at Black Mountain. So, as you said, this is a tiny school, often with like 20 or 30 students. And you just can't believe how many of these students went on to really gigantic careers. Was it something in the water? Was it something in the strange atmosphere of the place. But, you know, my own theory is that it did have something to do with this incredible crossing, interweaving of indigenous American try-anything exploration and a highly sophisticated, rarefied European sensibility. And, you know, by 1950, people like Charles Olson, the incredible visionary poet, is there, writing his Mayan letters to Robert Creeley, who's also involved with the place. And in the 50s, Black Mountain really reinvents itself as a kind of writer's commune, and produces what we still think of as the writings of the Black Mountain School of Poetry, you know, for a school that only existed from about 1933 to about 1956. It just has a completely outsized influence, not only on American culture, but on American education. Colleges have been trying ever since to reproduce some of the experimental excitement of this school that for a long time did not have permanent buildings, did not have a board of trustees, did not have, of course, an endowment. It's laughable to think of Black Mountain College having an endowment. And yet it had, you know, some of the greatest of all painters, poets, and scientists, you know, great mathematician, Max Dan. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just, it makes you, you know, it introduces this subject of ephemerality versus institutionality that, you know, in our modern time, a Black Mountain, well, and there have been others similar to it, but it's hard to imagine one existing because the impulse is to try to build it so that it lasts forever.
Exactly.
Whereas their impulse was to survive. And in fact, you know, Olson's, you know, period of, you know, he sort of presided over the fall of, you know, the end of Black Mountain. And you know, and maybe just it existed in a period of time for a reason, and then it had to, you know, it just had to go away.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You used the word ephemeral. I reviewed that wonderful show. It was at the ICA in Boston, and then moved out west to California, to L.A., recent show on Black Mountain. And the piece I wrote for the New York Review of Books, we called A Wonderfully Ephemeral College. And, you know, I think what you say is absolutely right, that every instinct of a college these days is to be permanent, big mausoleum-like buildings, big endowment, you know, kind of an almost military notion of the school surviving no matter what. Black Mountain, exactly the opposite. And I was struck by how much even the imagery of the art at Black Mountain has this sort of ephemeral quality to it. Everyone is in love with autumn leaves. You know, Joseph Albers arrives and discovers the beauty of autumn leaves on the Blue Ridge, and he says, "Oh my God, these are the most beautiful colors in the world!" And he has all his students making artwork out of fall colored leaves, and people are dressing up as trees covered with leaves. But also the, you know, the music, like John Cage's 4:33, what could be more ephemeral than
that's right.
That, you know, the silent piece or
well, but that's it, but that's because this is art and an institution made and run by artists, and the difference—that's the difference
exactly.
Between, you know, that it's kind of that the school itself was a piece of art, and art does not last. It lasts,
exactly.
But it doesn't have to be institutional to be art.
No, exactly, and it's no accident that the first happening happened at Black Mountain College. You know, the idea that this moment in itself is a performance no matter what you do. And there is, you know, there's Rauschenberg hanging his black and white paintings and Merce Cunningham dancing with a dog and somebody's, you know, playing Edith Piaf records and John Cage is reading some Zen Buddhist tract that is meant to support all of this chaos and beauty. But I think that's absolutely right. The college as a work of art, which left, you know, half the outsiders sort of scratching their heads and saying, is this a school at all? And the other side looking on in envy and saying, whoa, that's
right.
You know, that's the real deal. That's education itself. And we're still fumbling. We still have no idea what education should be. And I served for 2 years as the dean at a school I love, Mount Holyoke College. And I was in on all of the insider discussions of, you know, where is college education going now? And, you know, the truth of the matter is, nobody has any idea where college education is going now. We're still as split as people were in the 30s. Should it all be skills-based and vocational, or should it be creativity-based? And we don't have a clue.
No, that's true. Well, I think that there are people who do think, I mean, who do have opinions, who have strong opinions about that. But I think, you know, just to go back to Black Mountain, I think like a place that you, I think, might be familiar with, Wyndham College.
Sure. Yeah, I went to the Putney School a few
right.
miles away from it. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are places that have to exist, I think, outside of mainstream educational institutions, because
Absolutely.
The institutions carry so much meaning and so much intention that it becomes difficult within those institutions. You know, my daughter went to Hampshire, and I think if you,
Another school modeled on Black Mountain College.
That's
yeah, my
right.
brother spent a year there. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it was built. When they founded Hampshire, it was because the colleges there recognized that the only way to establish an alternative was outside of the institutions that already existed.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Now, all of these schools. I mean, you mentioned Wyndham. Antioch is another. These are the schools that, are both our most ephemeral schools and the schools that in many ways leave the brightest sort of, you know, jet stream behind them. I think that progressive experimental impulse is still very, very, very much alive, as is its counterpart, a sort of, vocational train for the profession sort of ethos. It's very interesting. But Black Mountain is undimmed. I think it's great that there is now a whole, you know, expanding museum and study center trying to maintain some of the excitement of this school, and the exhibitions about it keep coming out. The books like mine about it keep coming out. And we're still trying to learn the lesson of Black Mountain. You mentioned the cover. It's funny, you know, I thought they'd put a picture of a Black Mountain on the cover. I love the way the hardback came out with, you know, just the letters, red brick, Black Mountain, white clay, and mountain is blue and clay is yellow. And I thought, yeah, go in a different direction.
Well, we should talk a little bit about some of the other elements of the book, because I couldn't miss the beginning of the book where you talk about growing up in Indiana. I think it's Richmond, Indiana,
you betcha.
A place that I've never been. But you mentioned at an early age, you had the opportunity to work on an excavation for one of the mound sites. It sounds like it was a Hopewell site.
Yes.
In Indiana, and it, you know, I've been spending a lot of time at mound sites lately, and I'm, you know, I think that it's, you know, what you've kind of hit on is this, and this is a theme in the book of kind of an emergence from the ground, you know, of history being within the ground and coming to the surface as a kind of discovery.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, you know, and you also I have to let you talk about the story of Bartram and William Bartram, who I think is an amazing American character, but also I knew about Bartram. What I did not know about was Wedgwood and the search for the white clay in North Carolina. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's a really important story that I doubt that very many people know about.
So the idea of an archaeological impulse in this book came to me pretty early on, that I was doing some kind of archaeology. I had been excited by the romance of archaeology growing up in eastern Indiana. We lived in an area both rife with fossils, the Ohio River Valley limestone fossils, but also a lot of Indian artifacts. And the best summer job I ever had was working with a crew of students from Earlham College, the little Quaker school in India in Richmond, where my father taught organic chemistry. And they were patiently excavating one of these Indian mounds, Hopewell Mounds, in the middle of a cornfield in Centerville, Indiana. And this must have been in about 1967. It was wonderfully romantic for me. The Earlham College students were hippies, and they were beautiful, and they didn't wear a lot of clothes, and their work was patient and mysterious, and every once in a while we would uncover some tiny clay artifact, and we would listen to music. I remember that strange song, In the Year 2525, If Man Is Still Alive. And that just seemed the perfect sort of time-traveling soundtrack for this summer of mine. And that archaeological dream runs through the book. I felt like I was doing a kind of archaeology of my own family, of North Carolina. And as I was digging around, I came across this incredible story about Josiah Wedgwood, he of the great industrial potteries of Staffordshire near the city of Stoke-on-Trent in England. This is where not only Wedgwood, but Spode and all of the great so-called China of England comes from the Staffordshire area. And Wedgwood in the 1770s, he wanted to imitate porcelain. He didn't want to actually make high fire porcelain, which is really vitrified pottery. It's almost glass pottery. He wanted to make pottery that looked enough like porcelain that he could that all the stuff wouldn't blow up in the kiln the way it often did with porcelain. So he wanted a really white clay, and he started hearing rumors of white clay in these Cherokee parts of western North Carolina. And Wedgwood, totally global thinking, he said, "I'll just send some guy there, and we'll just dig up a few tons of this white clay, and we'll just bring it back up through Liverpool to Stoke-on-Trent." And he sends this guy who just boards a ship, goes to Charleston, buys some mules, and goes up into probably the most dangerous part of the country at that particular time, the most dangerous part of the British colonies. And damned if this guy, with Cherokee guides and overland treks and incredibly dangerous stuff and rain and just really hard country, they're going up into the Smoky Mountains. This guy finally reaches the place where there is this source of kaolin, which is still the major clay of porcelain production. and he digs 5 tons of what was known as Cherokee clay. The year is 1775. You know, there's already the beginnings of the American Revolution. And he manages to get the 5 tons of clay back to England, and Wedgwood successfully makes what is now known as jasperware, one of the great, great, great products in the history of international pottery, made from this Cherokee clay dug up in North Carolina. Now, soon after that, the great naturalist William Bartram, Quaker from Philadelphia, is hired by British gardeners to go into the outback and find samples of new plants for these unbelievable gardens that aristocrats in England had for themselves along the Thames. And William Bartram, very strange man, very strange temperament, more comfortable with Indians than he is with white men, more comfortable with rattlesnakes than he is with Indians, just a really interesting guy. And Bartram is aware of this earlier Wedgwood journey, and he follows exactly the same trail up into the mountains. He finds the source of white clay. He's finding tea plants and ginseng plants along the way to send back to England, and he's meeting Cherokees, some hostile, some not. He's a Quaker. He makes his own peace with them. And around the time that I'm working on Bartram, I'm going back through some family trees of my mother's. I had no idea that my mother, a Methodist from North Carolina, had way, way back in her background Quaker ancestors in Philadelphia. And I come across the name Mendenhall, and I realized that that is also a name in Bartram's family. And I discover that Bartram and my mother have these cousins in common, all coming out of Philadelphia. So William Bartram is another of the strange family figures that this archaeological method adds to the story. But that's the white clay of the title, this incredible journey back. So the book is structured so that the three parts move progressively west in North Carolina, from the Piedmont in the east to Black Mountain towards the west, and then this very distant part of North Carolina where the Cherokee clay is. And it also moves back in time, so there's a kind of three-part progression both in space and time.
It's a pretty interesting kind of congruency, too, that you have on your father's side. You have the Albers, who end up in the same geographical location. You know, I like that congruency as well. And they are so, they're just as out of place in a way in North Carolina.
Exactly.
But at the same time, perfectly. I mean, because I think the way I think about the Albers is that they actually carried them everything in their heads with them wherever
Absolutely.
They went. And they were not people of place as so much as they were people of mind. And
yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And Annie Albers, my grandmother's big sister, said the wonderful thing about pre-Columbian artifacts was that they were so small, and she said you can take them anywhere. And you know, during World War II, she had lost all of her jewelry to the Nazis, all of the things she cared about, all of the objects. So she started making jewelry during the war out of ordinary plumber's washers and safety pins and dish drains and so on. And these look like the most elegant jewels you could possibly imagine. And as you say, I mean, the Alberses, they traveled light. They traveled with ideas. They traveled, they made art with leaves. They had a kind of poor art quality. You know, there were no looms, there were no spinning wheels, there was no anything at Black Mountain at the start, and that was a source of freedom and opportunity for these amazing people. But absolutely, that sense of people being out of place is a big theme in the book. These sort of homeless Jewish wanderers meeting homeless Quaker wanderers in the Cherokee towns of North Carolina. I mean, the great thing about writing nonfiction, as Mark Twain said, I think Mark Twain actually said everything smart that Oscar Wilde didn't say, but Mark Twain said the great thing about writing nonfiction is it doesn't have to be plausible. It just has to be true. And, you know, the more strange coincidences and confluences and patterns I found, the more grateful I felt. I thought nobody would believe this unless it were true.
Well, in some ways, you did exactly what you just described Annie Albers doing. You made the art from the objects at hand.
Yeah.
Which was, well, you know, your family story.
Nicely
so.
Put. Yep.
Well, no, it's a wonderful book. That's a great way to understand it, that it's a kind of also a weaving in a lot of ways of different elements. So you can think of the book as a piece of tapestry in that literal way. I think that's good.
Yeah, I love that description. It works for me.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me about it. I think we probably could have talked longer, but maybe we can talk again about another book.
I can't wait.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Plan on it. Great talking to you, David. Thanks a lot.
It's good talking to you. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Chris Benfey about Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay.